The EU's right to repair rules officially took effect today across all 27 member states. And this is a story that I think deserves more attention than it's getting in the general tech press. The directive covers a significant range of consumer products: smartphones, tablets, laptops, household appliances, and it creates a genuine legal right for consumers to have devices repaired rather than replaced. Manufacturers are now required to make spare parts available at reasonable prices, provide repair documentation, and offer repair options instead of replacement as their default warranty response.
The HN thread had 80 comments and was characteristically nuanced. The optimistic read is that this creates real structural pressure on companies like Apple, Samsung, and 100 others to redesign products for repairability. The skeptical read is that compliance is easy to game. You can technically provide spare parts while making them expensive enough that independent repair shops can't afford to stock them, or you can provide repair documentation that's technically complete but practically unusable.
The enforcement question is the one that matters. EU consumer protection regulation has a mixed track record at the enforcement layer, particularly when the companies being regulated are large US multinationals. The GDPR is the comparison everyone reaches for. It had teeth, but the enforcement timeline was long and geographically uneven. Right to repair may follow a similar trajectory.
Still, the direction of travel matters. Even if enforcement is slow, these rules change the design calculus for manufacturers operating in the EU market. And because the EU is large enough that companies don't design separate product lines for it, the rules tend to have global reach. The iPhone sold in California has to meet EU repairability requirements because Apple isn't going to make a Europe-only iPhone.
The malware story is in a different category entirely. This is Kaspersky's Securalist reporting on malware found embedded in Android-based automotive head unit firmware. Head units are the infotainment systems in cars, the screen that controls navigation, audio, climate controls. The malware they found was at the firmware level, meaning it was present before the car's owner ever interacted with the system.
The supply chain implications here are serious. Head unit firmware is typically developed by Tier 2 automotive suppliers, often with significant outsourcing. The attack surface is large, and the security culture in automotive embedded systems has historically been weaker than in consumer electronics or enterprise software. If you can compromise the head unit firmware before it ships, you have persistent access to a device that's in motion, potentially connected to cellular networks and in close proximity to people who trust it.
The Hacker News discussion on this was pointed about the broader pattern. We've seen this type of supply chain compromise in other hardware categories. The server motherboard implant allegations from a few years ago, compromised router firmware, malicious code in USB devices. The automotive context adds a physical safety dimension that makes it categorically different from, say, a compromised smart speaker.
The FDA Alzheimer's blood test clearance is a story I want to make sure we give proper weight to. Washington University School of Medicine announced FDA clearance for a blood test designed to aid in the evaluation of Alzheimer's disease. This is significant because the current gold standard for Alzheimer's diagnosis involves either a PET scan, which costs thousands of dollars, or a spinal tap, which is invasive. A blood test that can flag elevated amyloid or tau biomarkers changes who gets screened and how early.
The clinical nuance here matters. FDA cleared to aid evaluation is different from FDA approved to diagnose. The test isn't replacing the full diagnostic workup. It's a triage tool that can help physicians decide which patients need the more expensive and invasive follow-up testing. But in a disease where early intervention is increasingly meaningful, earlier identification of at-risk patients has real consequences.
The HN thread was small, only 17 comments, but the comments that were there were from people with relevant clinical and research backgrounds, which is one of those moments where HN comments genuinely add texture you don't get elsewhere. The discussion touched on false positive rates, the implications for insurance coverage, and the question of whether earlier identification of Alzheimer's risk actually improves outcomes given the current state of treatment options.
The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has crossed 5,200 recorded cases, and I want to flag this even though the HN discussion is small. The outbreak has now been active for more than 100 days since declaration. The DRC has dealt with Ebola outbreaks repeatedly. This is the 17th since the first documented outbreak in 1976 near the Ebola River. The challenge in the DRC is consistent: remote geography, limited healthcare infrastructure, and community trust issues that affect containment efforts.
The WHO is involved and vaccines are being deployed, but 5,200 cases over 100 days is a significant sustained transmission rate. This is a global public health concern that deserves monitoring, even if it's not generating the media attention of past outbreaks.